The Whole Health Cure with Dr. Sharon Berquist, the podcast that brings you inspiration and skills for living a healthy and fulfilled life.
Hello, everyone. I'm so glad you're joining us on The Whole Health Cure. I'm your host, Dr. Sharon Berquist. On this podcast, we explore the science behind true health and living a physically, emotionally, and spiritually fulfilled life. I'm joined today by Matt Rusigna. We are going to be talking about the evidence behind and practical ways you can follow a plant-based diet to prevent and manage chronic diseases such as diabetes and heart disease. Matt is a registered dietitian, the past chair of the vegetarian group of the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, co-author of No Meat Athlete, and the current chief nutrition officer for Nutrinic, a healthcare company that uses plant-based diets to reduce risk for chronic diseases. Matt, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me, Dr. Berkowitz. It's an honor to be here and talking about these topics that are very important to me.
Yeah, so how did you get interested and started in plant-based diets?
You know, I came into it a little bit different. I came from the ethical angle and about treatment of animals. And that is actually what started my interest in nutrition in high school and is why I followed through with going and getting two nutrition degrees. So that aspect came first. And then I just wanted to learn about the nutrients that we needed if you're eating plant-based. And it was only then in graduate school at Loma Linda where I learned about the plant-based for prevention and treatment and how strong it is and the evidence that's there.
And from the environmental standpoint, you know, for our listeners that aren't familiar with environmental impact of, say, plant-based diet versus more of an animal-based diet, can you speak a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I can a little bit. You know, it's an inefficient system to grow food to then feed to animals and then eat those animals. You know, we talk about soybeans and deforestation. Most of the soybeans are being fed to animals, which are then fed to humans. And so it's just an inefficient way to use land. And eating those plants directly can have a positive impact on all sorts of environmental factors. You know, from water to land use to energy use to, you know, even CO2 in the environment.
Absolutely. And it's amazing that what's good for the environment is also what's good for humans. Kind of a win-win there.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And in the healthcare company Nutrinic, what was the impetus behind starting that?
So I'm trained as a dietitian, but my other training is in public health, which I like to think of as the application of nutrition knowledge. And most dietitians work clinically, but I was out in the world working with groups of people, and I found that what they needed wasn't more knowledge, what was support in making these behavior changes. And so the idea with Nutrinic is we created a 6-week program that is focused on diabetes prevention. But you know, the same thing that works for diabetes prevention also works for heart disease prevention and other cardiovascular diseases. And so our idea was to bring sort of public health mindset of really supporting people as they change their behaviors in order to reduce their risk of chronic diseases down the road. So its idea is that we work with, we do corporate wellness and hope to work with some hospitals in the future. So when a patient hears that they have prediabetes or they're at risk for diabetes, they can be put into a program where we hold their hand and help them make these changes. Because the hardest part of any change is the beginning. You know, where do you find the food? How do you cook it? How does this work? You know, so if we can help people over that biggest barrier, then we think they're more likely to eat healthy for the rest of their life. And that's what we want, right? A long-term lifestyle change.
Oh, yeah. And of course, we all have a lot of patients that are in that pre-diabetic range. In fact, just had a few today with that. And I think the empowerment to help people actually control and reverse their own disease is just such an important part of healthcare.
Right. And I tell people all the time, it's difficult to eat well. It's not an easy thing. You know, we point to all these cases of like so-and-so lost 100 pounds and now they run marathons. Well, those people are extremely motivated and they overcame many barriers. And when people don't, you know, lose 100 pounds, they say, hey, maybe this isn't for me and maybe I'm not that motivated, and they give up, right? The statistic on people putting on weight they lose within 2 years is what, like 97%? It's a difficult thing to do. And we find that telling people that it's hard helps them because they say, oh, okay, it's not just me. This is a hard thing to do. And it is. It's, you know, our environment is set up in such a way that eating well and getting physical activity is harder than it should be.
Oh, absolutely. I think to your point, it's the maintenance part and the sustainability that are the biggest challenge in our culture. And when somebody starts the program, what are the basic principles behind even, you know, the physiology? How do you combine that with the advice that you give people?
So we, you know, we do teach knowledge as well. Right. We go beyond knowledge and the handholding and the behavior change, but we teach knowledge based on how foods affect your physiology. And one we talk a lot about is insulin resistance, in that our bodies, you know, decades of poor eating, that we've built up a resistance to insulin in the cells. And so people think of carbohydrates, oh, carbohydrates are bad, I can't have carbohydrates because they cause diabetes. And they say, no, that isn't true. But these high fiber foods, high phytochemical foods, which are, you know, beans and fruits and vegetables, can help increase your insulin sensitivity to bring down your blood glucose. It's not the carbohydrates turning into sugar.
And, you know, I would say that is probably one of the biggest misconceptions I see. When I have patients who are either diabetic or pre-diabetic, I think the messaging has become low carb. And
mm-hmm, absolutely.
Misdirects a lot of people's dietary choices to avoid the higher quality carbohydrates that are high in fiber. And I think that's such a critical missing piece of, I think, the education component. And then you also mentioned the insulin resistance part. Do you promote reducing fats, and how's your program based in terms of the saturated fat versus polyunsaturated fats?
So our diet that we promote would be considered low fat by the standard definition of fewer than 30% of calories from fat. And then because it's predominantly plant foods, it's going to be low in saturated fat. I don't know what the percentage would end up being, but definitely under 5% of total calories. And compared to some of the other programs, especially in the plant-based nutrition world, we allow a little more fat. You know, if you look at like Esselstyn and Engine 2 and some of those, the diet that they promote is extremely low fat. You're talking like under 10%. We probably are around the 10 to 15% range, but we don't have people calculate. You know, we talk about foods, not nutrients, as we like to say. And really, it's about adding more healthy foods to crowd out the less healthy foods.
And for our listeners who may not know the physiology behind the lower fat recommendation regarding the saturated fat or the benefit of the fiber, can you explain that a little bit more?
Sure. You know, we address it partly through the physiology, that saturated fat may make it harder for our cells to take up insulin. And insulin's role is to remove glucose from the blood. And so when someone gets a reading, you know, and they see their blood glucose is high, you know, it's not just an issue of what goes in, but it's how that glucose comes out of the blood. And saturated fat may have a negative impact on these insulin receptors. So if we can reduce the saturated fat, that can help lower that blood glucose level. And then secondly, and maybe more important, is about caloric density. Fat is very calorically dense. And so it's easier to eat more calories of fat than it is carbohydrate or protein. So by lowering fat, it means that people can eat a larger volume of food and be full. You know, it's not a restrictive diet.
Absolutely. And so if there's, you know, a person that comes to your program that is pre-diabetic or diabetic, you provide them with the information. And then, as you pointed out, I think some of the challenges are getting started and then sticking with the types of dietary changes they need to make. What are some tips or pointers for people who are in that situation that could help them get started?
I think something about our brains as humans, like, we want to tackle the most complicated issues first. And I don't think that that's good advice. You know, it's like with bike commuting, people say, well, I have to ride 20 miles and bring my laptop, and sometimes it rains. And it's like, okay, let's back up and try something easier first. You know, can we bike commute 1 mile to the store instead of the 20 miles? And I think that with nutrition, it's similar. And so I have people look at the easiest things to change. And sometimes they push back because they think if it's easy, then they shouldn't be doing it. It's not worth doing. And I say, no, let's change the easy things, make those habits, and then address the harder situations, you know, because it's about what you do most often. And so it's a long way of answering your question, saying we focus first. First thing we do is we try to change people's breakfasts. And we're a big fan of doing overnight oats, because you do it the night before and you wake up in the morning and it's ready.
That's a popular one in our house, so I'm glad that we're on track.
And, you know, I don't love oatmeal. I've always thought of it as camping food, like something you have to eat when you're in the middle of nowhere. And so I was a little hesitant about overnight oats myself, but I like them much more than oatmeal. And especially now in the summer when it's hot, having this nice, cool breakfast filled with fruit. You know, I use frozen blueberries and a little bit of peanut butter, and it's a great breakfast.
That sounds delicious. I'll have to start adding the peanut butter piece to ours. And that's great. So, but that's really good advice of kind of starting with low-hanging fruit, kind of don't need to move mountains, but just start with some of the baby steps. And to your point, I think it is human nature to kind of want to kind of bite off a big chunk and really want fast results. And in reality, that may not be a good strategy.
Right. And as healthcare providers, it's difficult because you want people to change enough that they'll see results. Because if they don't see results, they're going to stop doing it. But you don't want to change too many things and see big results, because then most often it's unsustainable long term. And so you have to really balance that. We have people say, you know, I haven't really lost any weight, and I don't know if this is working, and I'm doing all this stuff, and I'm eating all these beans, and I'm just not sure about this. And then when we say, okay, well, how much weight have you lost? People will be like, well, only like 9 or 10 pounds, but it's been 3 weeks. And I say, wait a minute, that's great. Let's back up here. You lost 3 pounds a week. That's more than we recommend. And I think part of the issue is that people are used to these quick fix diets. So if they don't see those results, they think it's not working.
Yeah, and I think it's cultural. I mean, I think we kind of want quick results, whether it's customer service or diet. You know, it's, I think we're all wired that way right now. And for people, what is realistic? I mean, I think that's just a great way to frame for anybody who's trying to make a change of how to interpret if something is working. Like, what should people expect?
You know, I say 1 to 2 pounds a week is a good result. If you're consistently losing weight, then you're consistently losing weight. And 1 to 2 pounds is healthy because you're not overly restricting calories. You know, that's an issue that we came across that we weren't expecting when we rolled out this program, was that people would restrict their food more than we told them to, because they're used to restricting for diet. And we'd say, no, you can eat more. You can eat until full, because then you're less likely to snack or do other things. You can actually eat until you're full.
And that's, you know, again, just such a really important point, because it's the quality of what you're eating much more than the quantity. And so when you put eat full, you're saying eat full of the healthful items. So what are the unlimited keep eating types of foods you recommend?
You know, fruits and vegetables, of course, getting people to eat just larger servings. You know, we have this idea in our head of what a serving looks like, and we should be eating more. You know, a serving of broccoli is half a cup cooked. I mean, it's a couple of sprigs. It's nothing, right? Right. We can easily have one or two cups of cooked broccoli. And that's just a mental switch for a lot of people, is to see a plate of food that is so big. But that's the exciting thing about plant-based diets, is you can eat a larger volume of food. So if you like eating, you can keep eating, right? If you're eating more vegetables and more fruits. And then beans probably fit into that category for most people. They're going to be full before they would eat too many beans. I don't know what too many beans would be, but, you know, beans fit in there. And then whole grains.
I can predict what the limiting factor on the beans is going
to be. Let me make a point about beans, because this is something that I've learned, is in working with a lot of people who are introducing beans, you know, steadily for the first time in their lives, is chewing beans all the way really, really helps with gas and digestion. And that's something people don't realize. It's not necessarily the beans. It's not chewing them enough, because they're so smooth, and we just people swallow them whole and they don't realize.
Interesting. And the chewing breaks down the particles that release gas, or how does that work differently?
It just makes it easier for our stomach to digest, you know, pre-broken down pieces of food, you know, one, because they're smaller and then they're mashed. And then, you know, the digestion process with carbohydrates starts in our mouth, and our teeth are there for a reason. And so it can help start that process in the way it's supposed to go. I mean, I joke sometimes that you could have a diet book that the whole entire book is chew thoroughly and eat slower. Without changing anything else, I think people would see results.
Yes, that would be a good message. And I really like the shift in mindset that, you know, you just said, that when we look at serving sizes with a plant-based diet, those are the minimum targets, not the maximum targets. And that is such a shift from, you know, for example, when we're looking at, you know, how much fast food or how much dessert we can have. You know, it's such a different reason why we have servings and portions. And that's
right.
That's really a great recommendation for changing the mindset around just how to eat and eat healthy in a way that you can lose weight and be full all the time.
Mm-hmm. Because people need to be satisfied, you know, and we look at, oh, plant-based diets, and look at all these positive effects, and, you know, look how good it is for your health and getting cholesterol down. And we have that data, and the data is strong, but are people going to do it, and are they going to be satisfied? And that's kind of where I'm trying to, you know, make an imprint here in this world, is saying, like, look, there are things we need to learn in order to make it yours, right? You need to find the way the foods work for you.
Yeah, what are the biggest challenges you find that people have?
Well, one, people come into, not just our program, but probably any program, where they have a preconceived idea of what they're supposed to be doing. And, you know, as healthcare providers, we have to figure out what they are thinking we mean when we say certain things. You know, and when we say beans, oh, we need to eat more beans, they may have a limited idea of what a dish of beans looks like. And so for me, it can mean a million different things. I'm imagining Ethiopian food and Mexican food and tofu and Thai food. But for some people, they may not have that exposure to plant foods. And so we need to recognize that and then expand for them, you know, the range of foods that they could be eating.
Yeah, it's so interesting that, you know, we all speak the same language, but how those words can mean different things based on people's life experiences.
What is normal? You know, a lot of people say, you know, make strong statements like, no, this is what those people eat, and it's exactly this. And it's like, well, that's their own experience, right? And so how do we understand people's own experience to then expand it? You know, and that's a sort of mental, like, sociological perspective on what we do as healthcare providers.
Yeah, and do you just encourage people to break out of that by just experimenting, or do you have set recipes, or what's the best way to kind of broaden that outlook?
So what I first do is learn about what people are already doing, and then we can implement changes there. And we say, okay, you already like these plant foods, let's add more of those. Let's cook them in different ways. Let's try different versions of those. And then I try to slip in some recipes that are new but should be acceptable to them. And we coach people that you're going to make mistakes. You're going to go to the store and you're going to buy ingredients and you're going to come home and make dinner. And that dinner might be terrible sometimes. And that is okay, right? Like, we fail at all sorts of things. And it's the same thing with changing your diet. It's like, there are going to be failures. And did you waste money? Hopefully not, because you're on this longer process where you will learn that, okay, I don't like mushrooms, but I like this other type of mushroom or something.
Oh, absolutely. And do you encourage everyone that goes through the program to cook their own meals, or do you have certain shortcuts for people that just feel that they don't have the time to do it?
What we encourage is building meals, right, as opposed to following exact recipes. And those building of meals can have different inputs. And what I mean by input is you can eat beans a number of different ways. You can go to the health food store, buy them organic in bulk, bring them home, soak them, cook them overnight, flavor them yourself, and then make tacos with them. Or the other far end of that is going to fast food and getting a bean taco, right? These are different ways to eat tacos. And so we try to figure out where people are in this process and help them to take a step toward doing it themselves.
Mm-hmm. So it's very individualized based on, you know, how people want to get those right foods into their bodies.
Exactly. And that, you know, people, we often say, you know, don't let perfection stop progress. Because it goes back to this idea of, you know, people's preconceived ideas about what they're supposed to be doing. And they think everything has to be organic, everything has to be fresh. And if it's not worth doing. And so I'm just going to go eat, you know, McDonald's or whatever. And it's like, no, it doesn't have to be perfect. You know, if you need to get a bean burrito out, that's fine. If you need to microwave a frozen one, sure. It's about eating those foods and eating more of, you know, legumes and whole grains and things. And so we just find different ways to do it. You know, we encourage frozen and canned. You know, maybe it's not ideal, but it's pretty close. And for someone who doesn't eat much of that food to begin with, it's a big step.
Oh, that's absolutely right. You know, perfect is the enemy of the good. And you know, any any shift, I think, towards eating healthy is just a step in the right direction. I think the all or nothing kind of makes it hard for any person to kind of feel that they can stick with something long term.
Right. And so we offer a lot of encouragement for people. It's like, no, you are doing it. You are making these changes. You know, you are losing some weight, because it doesn't take a huge change to get cholesterol levels down and to get blood glucose in a better range. You know, I mean, just adding legumes every day, you know, changing your breakfast and adding beans to one of your later meals. I mean, I think people would see results. I mean, there's some data on that, right? People just adding a cup of beans and their cholesterol coming down.
Yeah, and let's talk about that, because I know I get asked that all the time, and I'm sure you do. And you know, people ask me, well, how long do I need to do X or Y until, you know, we should retest my, you know, cholesterol or blood sugar? So what are the time points where people can actually see change in their numbers? What do you see?
You know, that's something we're learning, and we picked 6 weeks. Because it doesn't seem super long, and it's enough to, hopefully it's enough to see some change. And we have, our program is pretty new, but we have almost everyone who completes it and had some level of adherence sees at least a 10% drop in their cholesterol levels. So we have that data. And then some people are trickier, you know. Some people just can really adapt and they lose weight quickly. And other people, it takes a little bit longer for their body to adjust. And so 6 weeks might not be enough.
Mm-hmm. Right. And there's so many different endpoints. You know, obviously, people may lose weight at different rates, and cholesterol is probably a stronger genetic component than, say, blood sugar.
Mm-hmm.
For the different measurements, you see results quicker in one versus another. Yeah, and so what are other challenges that people have?
You know, the social component is really big. You know, no one wants to be the odd person out. And I think sometimes when someone is changing their diet and they're trying to get healthier, their friends may get defensive and say, oh, you don't want to eat this? So you think I shouldn't eat this? You know?
I made it just for you.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, I thought we were all going to go out and get nachos. What, you don't want to hang out with us anymore because you're on some diet, right? And that's a hard part. And, you know, when we look at the evidence, people who are supported socially are much more likely to stick to a behavior change. And so that's a tough one. You know, we have people whose like partners aren't interested at all. And so they're making two separate dinners every night. And that's really tough. You know, for people whose family and friends get on board, it's much easier. It's like anything, like any changes that we want to make. If people around you are doing it, it's easier. And so we try to help people find others who will support their change.
Interesting. So you help people find a community of like-minded people through the program, even if they don't have those supports built into their home and work environment.
Right, right. And we even help people socially try to like de-escalate it. You know, we say, hey, tell your friends that your time with them is very important and you still want to go out on Friday night, even if you're not going to eat the nachos, you know, and just reaffirm to your friend that it's not about the friendship, it's about getting healthier.
Yeah, it's kind of almost like peer pressure to smoke.
It is. It really is. And, you know, if we look at food as being detrimental, it's like there are a lot of ways to make it easier to eat poorly.
Yeah, it is. It's like you said, a double whammy where you're already trying so hard and then to have these inputs that are kind of working against you that are social and built into our environment is kind of adds to it. And you know, I want to also ask you about the No Meat Athlete. That's the about your book, Sports Performance in Plant-Based Diets. What have you seen there?
So, you know, it was an honor to work with Matt Frazier of No Meat Athlete, and I wrote the nutrition sections for his book. And that is a big movement, is eating plant-based in sports. And the research hasn't caught up yet, because unfortunately a lot of the research, it's hard to do a good controlled study with athletes because there's so many different factors coming in. But, you know, anecdotally, one thing that we hear is about recovery. And, you know, the mechanism might be the phytochemicals and antioxidants in fruits and vegetables may help with repairing cells.
Interesting. So the whole anti-inflammatory component in the recovery process and the antioxidants can maybe shorten that recovery time. Is that part of
it? Right. Exactly. And if we can show, if an athlete, you know, who's training for a big event or Ironman or 100-mile run or something, if they can quicken their recovery and get an extra workout in, then they're going to be at an advantage. And so that's interesting. And unfortunately, the research on antioxidants and recovering athletes is all using supplements. So we haven't seen a lot of good research that looks at people who are eating a diet that's very high in fruits and vegetables.
Which, you know, as we both know, can have such a dramatically different outcome, you know, in terms of the amount that is bioavailable to our bodies when we get it as a supplement versus in the actual food.
Right.
And so,
exactly. And that would be a tough study to do. You know, how do you find athletes that are performing at similar levels? And, you know, I'm not a researcher, so I, but it sounds like it's very difficult to me.
Right, right. And I think, yeah, athletes who are willing to follow a plant-based diet are, you know, and then, like you said, looking at the variances in these groups would be very hard to do. And, you know, protein keeps coming up in, you know, conversations about plant-based diets and especially about sports performance. I think a lot of people who are doing sports need to have a good amount of muscle mass to perform at a higher level. Can you speak a little bit about protein concerns with plant-based diets?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the first things that I always say, I just did a webinar on this topic yesterday, is that all whole plant foods have all of the essential amino acids. There's this idea that the amino acids are totally missing from some plant foods, and that's not true. You know, when we say that you should eat a variety of plant foods to get all the amino acids, what that means is you can't rely on just one food for all of the essential amino acids. But no one eats that way, right? That's just another way to say that, like, you can't only eat peanut butter or only eat broccoli, right? And no one does that, right? We eat a variety of foods. And so plant-based diets can give more than enough protein for everyone. You know, some people, it's a little bit harder. You know, bodybuilders, for example, the protein requirements are pretty high, but it is doable. But for most athletes, they're eating more food because their workouts require energy. And when you're eating more food, even if you're the same percentage of your calories from protein, that crude number of grams of protein goes up. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. It's obviously per 1,000 calories, you're getting adequate protein. And if you increase the calories, the amount of protein increases, which, as you're saying, would still be an adequate amount.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if I'm eating, you know, 70 grams of protein a day for a 2,000 calorie diet, and then I'm working out a lot and eating 4,000 calories, well, now I have 140 grams of protein without changing anything in my diet, just eating more.
Mm-hmm. And the quality of the protein for muscle mass, what advice would you give around that?
You know, we want to make sure that we're eating, you know, the high protein foods like legumes. And legumes includes beans and then things like lentils and split peas, but also green peas, which are, you know, traditionally eaten as a green vegetable, but they're a legume and they're high in protein. And so focusing on those foods can really help. And it's also a place where, like, meat alternatives or vegan meats can come in because they're very high in protein. So eating something like a tofurkey sausage, you know, adding that to your already plant-based meal can really up the protein content.
Yeah, so I think those are great ways to get the protein. And the meat alternatives, I think that market is rapidly growing.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So before, you know, we're almost out of time, I was going to just conclude by, you know, seeing what advice you would give to people who are interested in starting or continuing a plant-based diet.
You know, explore new foods and new ways to eat them and be open-minded, and you might surprise yourself. You know, with the foods that are out there now, there are all these alternatives and all these different ways to make them. Or another bit of advice is to try to simplify what you're doing. Let's make it easier, right? And we can do that by, you know, cooking in bulk. You know, when you make rice, make a bunch of rice and you have it left over, and then you can just throw some beans on it and hot sauce and bring it for lunch the next day, right? Is that it can be simple. You know, it's the meals that we don't think about that we eat that really affect our health. And if we can make those meals healthier and simpler, then, you know, we're well on our way to better health outcomes.
Yeah, I think that's really good advice. Well, Matt, thank you so much for joining us. And thank you for all the work that you're doing just to help more people get to healthier outcomes. I think, you know, this is just phenomenal to have the program that you do through Nutrinic.
Great. Well, thank you so much. I mean, it's an honor to speak with you. And anytime I get to talk about this, I'm happy. So thank you.
Thank you.
The Whole Health Cure is brought to you by the Lifestyle Medicine and Wellness Center at Emory. For more information about wellness assessments, classes, and other resources, please visit our website. This material is copyrighted by Emory University.